Okay, so we trying to get in the business of to explain why we have this structure for the spectra of hydrogen. So Bohr, 1913, has the s, p, and d levels of say n equals 3 all being exactly degenerate. And it was known even at the time that that wasn't the case, that there was so-called fine structure. And actually a relativistic version of Bohr's theory got the fine structure correctly. And it's kind of a job in order to make non-relativistic quantum mechanics do the same thing. It's not clear to me whether people were worried about that, because Bohr's theory was dead for other reasons, but it's kind of a slog in order to get these results. So kinetic energy doesn't equal 1/2 mv squared. Einstein tells us what the kinetic energy is, and there's a long series of corrections. The first correction of interest is that guy. The electron is moving through an electric field, and so it sees a magnetic field, we can Lorentz transform the F matrix and figure out what that magnetic field is and calculate the mu dot B energy that's associated with a magnetic dipole moment in that field. And there are a couple of non-obvious things that come in. We've mentioned it before, the gyromagnetic ratio of an electron is not the classical value. It's about twice as big. And then there's a subtle relativistic effect called Thomas precession, which I could say more than you want to. It's a pretty complicated story that also affects these terms. But if we take all that stuff together, we do finally get an energy that just depends on the J value of these states. So if we're adding, say, angular momentum 1/2 to angular momentum 1 as in a P state, we're going to get possibilities of them aligned or anti-aligned, and they have different total angular momentum, either 3/2 or 1/2, and they're split. And turns out that if the J values match, then the energies match, at least so far. It's real useful to remember this fine structure constant, which kind of orders these relatively important corrections. And in that regard, Bohr's story is that the energy is minus 1/2 mc squared alpha squared over n squared. Well, post-war, Lamb and Rutherford measure the shift between the S1/2 and P1/2 levels, called the Lamb shift. And it was pretty clear that that meant that we had to go beyond the Dirac equation, the relativistic quantum mechanics equation, where all of these things happen for free. And self-energy was the suggested problem. So for an instant, an electron can emit a photon and then reabsorb that photon. And we have a second order correction then to the energy of a free electron, basically the mass of an electron. And it turns out that if we do the second order correction, we get infinity. It has an ultraviolet divergence, that is to say that it's high energy photons that produce a sum that is greater than infinity. And the solution is renormalization, where we say that what we measure for mass is going to include this effect already. So really we're interested in the difference between what this effect is for a free electron and what this effect is for an electron that's bound in a hydrogen atom. So there's a famous conference in, I think still 1947, might have been 48, the Shelter Island Conference that had a bunch of superstars. And on his way home from that conference, Bethe figured out how to do that calculation non-relativistically. The real full story of renormalization, at least the people who got the Nobel Prizes for it, were Schwinger, Feynman, and Tominaga. Schwinger had a very complicated way of doing it. Feynman has his Feynman diagrams, which bring these sorts of calculation to the masses. And I don't know much about Tominaga. So I've at least met these guys at various times. Dyson is the guy who, on a car trip with Feynman across the country, finally understood what Feynman was talking about and wrote it up. So kind of okayed Feynman's kind of wide-eyed ideas. So soon thereafter, people were looking at coupling the nuclear spin to the electronic spin. So a proton has spin 1/2, it's going to make a magnetic field, it's going to interact with the electron's magnetic dipole moment. And it turns out that this is dependent upon how much the electron is inside the proton. The outside the proton effect actually cancels, so it's just the inside of proton effect that's there. And it depends on the dot product of the proton spin and the electron spin, and so we can rewrite that in terms of the total spin. And you know, as usual, we are going to have total spin, which I'm labeling J, but most commonly at this point would be called F. So we would have J plus the nuclear magnetic dipole moment is F. And famously, that change in energy, that hyperfine structure, corresponds to a wavelength about 21 centimeters or 1420 megahertz. It's a highly forbidden transition with a lifetime measured, I think, in millions of years. But there's a lot of hydrogen in the universe, so it's very common for radio telescopes to be listening in on this particular type of emission from nebula and things like that. Luckily, all of this wasn't, well, I don't know, there was a fair amount of algebra, but it's in some sense not super hard, because we could just use non-degenerate perturbation theory. That is to say, we're always just calculating the expectation value of the potential as opposed to having to diagonalize some matrix. And the reason we could do that is that the potential doesn't connect states in the degenerate subsystem, so we don't get an infinity if we imagine doing second order perturbation theory. And the reason it doesn't connect it is that it commutes with J squared and JZ. So orbits with different J and JZ, if you calculate the corresponding matrix element, you're going to get zero. And classically, what that corresponds to is that these effects don't depend on the orbit orientation, right? So if we're changing M, we're just changing the orientation of that orbit. It still should have the same amount of kinetic energy, no matter what the orientation of it is. And the L dot S term, whatever the orbit is, that's what it is. If it's in a different plane, it really shouldn't matter. So things were relatively easy, except for some algebra. Questions? So all these guys got Nobel Prizes except Dyson, who is still alive, and so could get a Nobel Prize, I guess. I bet he's been nominated lots of times. He's pretty old. Okay, so that's the end of chapter 6. On to the next approximation method, which is called the variational. Well, we like to name things for dead physicists, the Rayleigh-Ritz. Rayleigh is the guy who did this outside of, in the context of classical physics, and Ritz is the guy who first applied it to quantum mechanics. I guess I say the word first, I haven't checked that out, right? All the time, things are not named for the person who did it first, but for the person who got publicity for doing it. And the variational method is, I don't know, all of these methods are super important, I guess. People who are doing calculations like for theoretical chemistry very commonly are using the variational method because it's super amenable to computer calculation. And the story is about as, I think, as simple as you could imagine. The plan is you take some function which just depends on some arbitrary parameters. I don't care how many arbitrary parameters they've got. And of course, it's going to depend on space. And then go ahead and calculate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. So let me call that E. And obviously, if the function depends on these parameters, the result of doing this integration is going to depend on the parameters. We've integrated out the R dependence. And what we'll show in a second is that we are guaranteed that this energy is greater than or equal to the actual ground state energy. And that it's quote unquote quadratically accurate. And what I mean by quadratically accurate is if you're off, if your function here is missing the actual eigenfunction by some amount, let's call it delta F, then this energy will miss the ground state energy by, approximately speaking, delta F squared. So that you don't have to get super close to the actual wave function in order to get pretty accurate estimate, really upper bound, for that ground state energy. So, at least to start, this is just for the ground state energy. It's not going to give us anything else. But I'll comment right now, and we'll talk about it in a second. Not uncommonly, you can get this to give you, say, the first excited state or the lowest energy for any value of angular momentum. But it takes a little bit of trickery. Okay, so first let's prove this theorem. So whatever this function is, it can be expanded in terms of the actual eigenfunctions of the system with some expansion coefficients ci. Obviously, these coefficients are going to depend on a, b, c, etc. That's of no particular meaning for us now. So if I calculate this integral, what I've got is the integral of the sum of C complex conjugated, phi I complex conjugated, Hamiltonian sum of C J, no complex conjugate, phi J, divided by the same thing without the Hamiltonian in it. So you know orthogonality is going to make this thing easy, right? The only terms that are going to contribute are the ones where I equals J. So what we're going to have here in the denominator is just the sum of the magnitudes of Ci squared. And it's going to work pretty similarly upstairs too, because when the Hamiltonian hits this wave function, it's going to give us the corresponding energy times that wave function. So what we've got then in the end is that. And I don't know if it's obvious that that's greater than or equal to the ground state energy, but I hope I can convince you of it in the following. So let me call that quantity the weight. And I hope it's clear that if I sum those weights, I get 1. Because I just have exactly the same thing in the numerator and the denominator. So what we've got here is what you would call the weighted average of the energies. And obviously, the average has to be more than the smallest. Right? Some people are more convinced than others. So I guess you're not convinced maybe that that's an average. But if you, it's exactly what you would calculate for your, you know, average grade in a class where you've been told that this percentage of it is from tests and this percentage of it is from homeworks, right? You take those percentages, multiply them by the grades, and you get the result. And the one thing you know for sure is your average grade is going to be better than your lowest grade. Okay, So let's talk briefly about this first order possibility. If I can somehow guarantee that there is none of the ground state in my selected function, okay, if I'm sure that C0, let me call that the ground state, is exactly equal to 0 in this kind of Fourier expansion of my function, then I have the weighted average of everything except the ground state, which has to be bigger than or equal to the smallest energy in the set, which is the first excited state. Okay, so how could you be sure that there was none of the ground state in your so-called trial wave function? Sometimes by symmetry, right? So for example, if we're thinking about kind of simple one-dimensional problems, we know that, so let's say we have a potential like a square well, we know that the ground state has to be symmetric. And so if our trial wave function is anti-symmetric, we know that there is none of the ground state in that solution, because the overlap integral has to be 0. And so so we know then that the results we're going to get are bigger than the first excited state. It's hard to push that much further, right? So in the context of one-dimensional problems, it would seem, you know, that the first order state looks kind of like that, and the second order state looks kind of like that. It would be hard to guarantee that the trial wave function doesn't have either of those two in there, right? You'd need something pretty special in order to go much beyond the first order state. Okay, so let's talk about this quadratically accurate and try and give it some sort of meaning. So let's say our trial wave function is equal to the exact ground state. Now I'll put a subscript on it, I'm not sure I'll exactly keep it for long, plus some amount of some other function, which I'm going to call g. So my trial wave function doesn't equal the real ground state, it's off by some amount, and I can adjust how much it's off by changing this parameter epsilon. So if I calculate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, so what this is going to be is the integral of phi 0 complex conjugated plus epsilon complex conjugated times g complex conjugated, h operating on the same stuff, I'm going to get this term here, which, because this is the exact eigenfunction, this is going to give me E0. I'm going to assume that my phi is normalized. Shall I assume that or not? I won't bother to assume it. It all comes out in the wash one way or the other. And I'm going to have this term here, which is the magnitude of epsilon squared. And if you look at the other two terms, right, one of these terms is this guy here, and that's equal to epsilon phi hg. And the other term is just the complex conjugate of it. And think about it, in the denominator, it works exactly the same way, except with no h in it, right? So what I'm going to get there is this term here with no e in it, then I'm going to get epsilon phi g plus the complex conjugate of that plus the magnitude of epsilon squared gg. Okay, so this is what we've been calling energy, which if F had some parameters in it, I would put those in there too. Okay, so now the kind of trick, when H operates on phi, it gives me that energy times phi. I don't know, so that term's looking a lot like this term here. Remember, H can operate this way too on the bra, and the energy is guaranteed to be real, so this is going to give me E naught epsilon g phi. So the only thing I need, really, is a term that is E magnitude of epsilon squared g and g. I can't just willy-nilly add that term, so I'm going to subtract it too. And let's see what we've got. Well, what we've got is exact, by design, we've got, in all of those terms, exactly what's in the numerator, except times E naught. So what we've got then is E naught. And now we've got these two leftover terms, both of which are proportional to epsilon squared. And they can be put together to be g h minus e naught g. And we have all of this ugly stuff in the denominator. But who cares? The whole term is proportional to epsilon squared. And that's what I wanted to prove. So in this sense, so this wasn't particular to the ground state. If our function f is close to any real eigenstate, then the energy we calculate from this numerator over denominator is going to be quadratically close to that exact energy eigenfunction. And of course, if it's quadratically close, that means that the derivative of that with respect to epsilon has to be zero. So if we now think in the general context where I put some adjustable parameters, the derivative of f with respect to those parameters being zero, that's going to make, oops, not f, of this quantity here, excuse me. If I take the derivative of that quantity with respect to those parameters and set them equal to zero, I can get the lowest upper bound to the exact ground state energy. Any of them will be an upper bound, but obviously I want the one that's tightest, the one that's closest to the, that's the smallest, right? The smallest upper bound sounds like a good idea. And what we see here is that while this statement was a statement about the ground state, in fact, we would expect any time that our wave function was close to any excited state, the derivative of all of those quantities would also be zero. We wouldn't know whether that was an upper bound or a lower bound, so it's not so useful, right? We don't know whether this quantity would be positive or negative, but it's probably going to be somewhat close to those excited state values. Okay, so it's pretty easy. You just guess a function, do the integrals, minimize that ratio, call that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, and you've automatically got an upper bound to the ground state. And it should be closer than you would think to the actual energy of the corresponding system. Okay, so I don't know, let's do some examples. So we've got our friend, the simple harmonic oscillator. So simple harmonic oscillator, the Hamiltonian is minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to x squared plus 1/2 m omega squared x squared. And we need a trial wave function. And at least if we're doing this on the blackboard, we want a trial wave function that we can actually integrate. And we know what the ground state looks like, right? It looks kind of like that. So we want something that's even and is bigger at x equals 0 than it is at other places. So how about the following? A squared minus x squared if x is less than a, and 0 if x is bigger than a, right? So this is an approximation that looks kind of like that. Not a great approximation, but we can see if we can live with it. At least it ought to be pretty easy to do the integrations. And in this case here, the adjustable parameter is a, right? I can stretch this thing out, I can shrink it, and I want the lowest possible upper bound for the ground state energy, which I hope you remember, the ground state energy is 1/2 h bar omega. Okay, so it's going to be off to the races. This term here is, it wouldn't be too bad to calculate for this particular problem, but it's often pretty much a mess to calculate. What we're talking about here is then calculating the expectation value of the second derivative of the function. And I might as well put the minus sign there in. And what we're going to do basically always is to use integration by parts. Or to be said differently, we can have the momentum, we can have one of these two momentum operators operate on this side and have the other one operate on that side. Right? So instead of literally calculating this, it's got to be the same thing as that. So basically, instead of calculating the second derivative, which would require calculating the first derivative, all we really want to do is to calculate the first derivative and do that integral. This thing has to be the same thing as that by integration by parts. Okay, do you believe that? Would you rather see it? So what we have here is the, and I'm going to get rid of my minus sign here. So we've got this quantity dx. To prove integration by parts, my typical way of doing is to write this as a pure derivative of something. But what I'm missing is this term here. Okay, so that's an identity. So what I've got then is the integral of the derivative, that's easy to do, minus the derivative of f squared. The integral of the derivative is just the function evaluated at the endpoints. And we do want to be a little bit careful about that. Our wave functions really should go to zero at the end, either because they're going to zero as x goes to infinity in the real wave function, or we want to have our wave function go to zero there. Okay, so that term is going to go to zero, and so we've got minus the integral of derivative squared. Okay, so anytime we're calculating the kinetic energy term, we're going to do it this way. There's kind of another benefit for that, and that is if I look at this quantity with that minus sign, is that positive or negative? It's not particularly obvious. You know kinetic energy has to be positive, but if I write it this way, it's clear that it's positive, right? Because it's the integral of something squared. Okay, so with all of that, let's go off to the races. So we need to do some integrals. So what we've got is going to be the integral over the range where the wave function isn't zero, so say from minus a to a, of the derivative with respect to x of that function squared. Okay, so first of all, at least for me, it's easier to, since it's a symmetric function, to have the range of integration. And then the derivative with respect to x of this function is going to be minus 2x. And that's pretty easily squared. Don't forget my square. That's going to be pretty easily integrated. 2 squared, so this is going to give us 8. And so we have the integral from 0 to a of x squared dx. The antiderivative is x cubed over 3. So we've got 8/3 of a cubed. Okay, so the other thing we need to integrate is the potential energy, which is proportional to x squared. And then we have our f squared. Everything's real, so I don't have to worry about complex conjugating these things. Okay, so I'm going to double the integral because to me it seems easier. So I have x squared, and then I have a squared minus x squared squared dx. And if I pull out this polynomial, this is a to the fourth x squared minus 2 a squared x to the fourth plus x to the sixth. And it's therefore pretty easy to integrate. So I have a to the fourth, the integral of this is going to be a cubed over 3. The integral of this is going to be a to the fifth over 5. And the integral of this is going to be a to the 7th divided by 7. Nicely, all of those depend on a to the 7th. So what we've got is 2 times a to the 7th times 1/3 minus 2/5 plus 1/7. Okay, so could seek a common denominator. I guess I'm going to do it in pieces. So this is 0.3 minus 0.4, so that's going to be a negative number. So it's 5/15 minus 6/15, so it's minus 1/15. And then I've got a 7th, need the common denominator between 7 and 15, which is 7 times 15 is 105. So I'm going to have minus 7 plus 15. So that's 8/105. And there is this overall multiplicative constant of 2. Okay, so then we have the normalization integral in the denominator, FF. So that's the integral from minus a to a of a squared minus x squared squared. And I'm going to make that, since it's nice and even, 0 to a. If I expand this guy out, this is a to the fourth minus 2 a squared x squared plus x to the fourth. And so when I do this integral, I'm going to get a to the fourth times a, and then I'm going to get minus 2 a squared a cubed over 3. And here I'm going to get a to the fifth over 5. integral is gone now. So nicely again, everything is proportional to a to the fifth. And I've got 1 minus a third plus a fifth. So 2/3 plus a fifth is going to be what, 13/15? Oh, 2/3 minus 2/3. So now it's 8/15. And it needs to be multiplied by 2. Okay, put all the pieces together. So what we have is the expectation value of the Hamiltonian divided by expectation value of the function. And for the derivative, we got that term, and that had a h bar squared over 2m multiplying it. So we've got that times 8/3 of a cubed. And the x squared had a 1/2 m omega squared next to it. And it was, don't forget this 2, it was 16 1/5 times a to the 7th. And then in the denominator, we've got 16/15 times a to the 5th. What's the chance that I got all of those terms right? Oh, so I have a mistake in my notes. So what's on the board is better than what's on my notes. I had a 4 there, which we know is wrong. Okay. So let's kind of put the pieces together a little bit. It's helpful, I think, to pull out the right answer, right? H bar omega over 2. And then we can kind of see how it's going to work. So what we have left over here is an H bar and an M and an omega. The omega wasn't there to begin with, so I have to kind of take it out. I've taken care of the 2, and I've got 8/3 of a cubed left. And here I've got the 1/2, I've got the omega, but I don't have the h bar. I don't think I like that. So I have the m, I have the omega, and I don't have the h bar, and I have the 1/2. So then I've got 16 1/5 times a to the 7th. And I don't know, I'm going to bring the 15/16 up. And I'm going to divide through all of these by a to the 5th. So this is going to be a to the minus 2, and this is going to be a to the plus 2. Well, if you look carefully, this and that are just one over each other. I don't know. So let's call that x. We don't really care about the numerical value of a. And certainly it's going to simplify life to just call that x. So what I've got then is the right answer, h bar omega over 2, a little bit smaller than the right answer, and then I've got 8/3 times 1 over x plus 16 115ths times x. Okay, so for any value of x, I get a value for the energy, which by what we've said should be more than the ground state energy, which is h bar omega over 2. And what we really want to do, though, is to get the smallest upper bound. So I want to minimize this quantity. And the way you minimize, the way you find maximums or minimums, is by taking the derivative and setting it equal to 0. So what I have then is minus 8/3 over x squared plus 116 over 105 wants to be 0. So if I bring this term onto this side of the equation and multiply it by x squared, I've got 16, 105, x squared wants to be 8/3. And I guess I can do some simplification here. So x is going to be the square root of 105 divided by 6. And you all know that we don't need calculators here, but since I did the earlier thing wrong in my notes, I don't know what happens if I plug in that number, and I guess I'm not going to bother to calculate it. But I'm pretty sure that the result is going to be, unless I made another mistake, all of this stuff better be a little bit more than 1, because we're expecting that the energy is going to be a little bit more than the ground state energy. Okay, so all of this is very amenable to doing Mathematica as opposed to doing it by hand. So let's do a different function. So we want a function that, you know, kind of looks like that. And you're probably not all that familiar with cosh. But the hyperbolic cosine looks like that. It gets exponentially big. So if we look at 1 over cosh, put an adjustable parameter there that says basically the size of it, that's a perfectly good trial wave function. It will look kind of like the real wave function. So what we can do is we can go through the same process. So on the top, I'm integrating the kinetic energy, right, where I've converted the double derivative to a single derivative on both sides. And I've calculated the potential energy, right, put in the x squared, have Mathematica integrate that. Calculate the normalization factor, the denominator. And then all I need to do is to put these various pieces together. Right, so instead of having this term here, I've got 2/3 of A. And instead of having this term here, I've got pi squared divided by 6A cubed. And instead of having this term here, I've got 2 over A. And if you look at how this is going to work out, it's going to work out basically exactly the same, right? So when I take this A and put it upstairs, instead of having an 8/3, I'm going to have a 4/3. Now I've got a 2 in the denominator too, right? So it's going to give me a 2/3. And instead of having this quantity that is 16/105, I'm going to have, right, so this A comes upstairs, so I'm going to get a 1 over A squared. Oops, this was all times A squared. And I'm going to get, oh, that was pi squared divided by, pi squared divided by 6. And it's going to be divided by 2 again, so it's going to be 12. So I can go through exactly the same process, right? It's an easy function to take the derivative of, and if I plug and chug through there, what I get is the exact answer times 1.25. Oops, no, that's what I get for the that's what I get when I do it wrong for the previous problem. So what I get here is 1/2 times 2.09. So I get 1.045 for that correction factor. So I'm getting the energy correct to about 4%. Okay, so flip it over to the back. So one thing that is, I don't know if it's obvious to you yet or not, carrying through all of these united quantities can become kind of a mess. It worked out pretty well for all of these cases, but we're better off dealing with the dimensionless quantity right from the start, as opposed to dealing with these dimensioned quantities. So lots of times we've taken the dimensioned equation and converted it to dimensionless form. So the problem at hand on the back side is where I have a pair of delta functions. And these delta functions in the end are going to be at x equals 2 and x equals minus 2. But in the start of this problem, I've got all of this minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives. I've got these delta functions that have some strength, which I'm calling w. And I have a delta function that's at one positive location and another delta function that's at a negative location. And of course, what I want to solve is h psi equals e psi. And if you go online, you can look at how we reduce this to dimensionless form. And when we do that, we just end up with using our new unit of length. And now we just have these delta functions. And we're going to get out dimensionless version of energy times psi. And then we don't have quite so many dimensioned units to concern ourselves with. So that's what I did. Here I've got a potential which has delta functions, which means the potential energy is very easy to evaluate. And for my trial wave function, I'm going to choose something that is anti-symmetric. Right? So you know, I hope that the ground state wave function is going to look kind of like that, and the first excited state is going to look kind of like that. It's going to be anti-symmetric. So if I want to estimate the energy of the first excited state, I can choose a function that is anti-symmetric, and that one is certainly anti-symmetric, and I can go and calculate all of these integrals. Gaussian integrals are particularly easy to calculate, and in fact, these days, typically these calculations are done by using a basis of, you know, maybe thousands of Gaussians, so you can approximate basically anything, and you can easily integrate it on a computer. And what I claim below is this is what I plot for the corresponding energy as a function of the free parameter B. Now, in this particular case, I can't analytically find where that minimum is, right? We can see that there's a minimum at, I don't know, something like 0.08 or 0.09. But exactly finding that minimum is kind of up for grabs. So if you flip it over, you can see how you do that sort of thing with Mathematica. Typically, what you're going to end up doing is plotting this energy, this ratio of H over the normalization, and looking to see where the minimum is, approximately, and then given a starting guess, Mathematica can use fine minimum in order to give you a good value for that minimum. Okay, so in this particular case, one can just eyeball it and see that the first excited state has to have an energy that's below, I would say, 0.06, minus 0.06, right, the minimum. Now, as a matter of fact, that's not a particularly great value for it. The in fact, energy is given at the bottom of these two for the even and odd state. So for the odd state, it's like minus 0.48. So we're kind of missing by a noticeable amount because this is not a particularly good wave function. What most of the rest of this page is doing some more not particularly good wave functions. So another choice you might make for these wave functions is a sum of Gaussians. Right? Put a Gaussian here at x equals minus 2 and a Gaussian here at x equals 2, where each one of these Gaussians is going to have that sort of flavor. Right? So we're going to have a wave function that is like that with the adjustable parameter A. And what we're doing here is then going through and calculating kinetic energy, the potential energy, the normalization. Then we're putting the kinetic energy divided by 2, right? Because there is actually this half in here. Plus the potential energy and dividing it by the normalization, plotting that up, and then finding the minimum. And I don't know if you can read this through, but we do a lot better. So instead of having 0.06 or minus 0.06, we're getting 0.3. Still not super close to what's basically minus 0.5. And again, the reason is that we're not doing a real good job approximating these functions, right? So this is actually a plot of what we get. So in terms of Gaussians, they don't have the sharp breaks in slope that we have because of the delta function. So they're not doing a super great job of approximating. But, you know, if you close your eyes, you can see that, yeah, these things are doing about as good a job as they could do for the real, the exact eigenfunction value. And again, they really are quadratically accurate. This thing seems to be off by quite a bit, but it's giving us an energy that is, you know, minus 0.3 as opposed to minus 0.5, something that's within shouting distance. And typically what is not uncommonly the case, and is the case for this problem, is while it's not doing a super good job of maybe getting the actual energies, the splitting is not too bad. The difference in energy between the ground state and the excited state calculated in this process is reasonably close. Okay, so that's variational method. Guess a function, calculate these integrals, find the best upper bound, typically using Mathematica, and then we're good to go.